In his memoir, A Song in the Night, Bob Massey, an Episcopal priest, politician, human rights activist, recounts his struggles with hemophilia, HIV, and hepatitis C, as well as his lifelong dedication to sustainability and helping others. His book is published by Doubleday. I'm very pleased that it has brought Bob Massey to our show. Hello.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Your parents, Robert K. Massey and Suzanne Massey, wrote a book called Journey in 1975 about raising you and managing your hemophilia. Did their book influence your decision to write your own memoir?
It did, because it's a wonderful book, but it came out almost 40 years ago, and it's very much their story as parents writing about an experience and about medical care in the 1950s and 1960s, and kind of ends when I'm in my teens. And I've had a long, winding road of a story since then, so I decided to give my own point of view in this book.
You were born with classical hemophilia. What does that mean, and how does it? Is there non-classical hemophilia?
That's a good question. I've never been asked that. I think it defines a form of hemophilia known as hemophilia A also, because there are different types of clotting disorders. You are missing a protein from your blood that enables the blood to clot quickly. Now, you don't have problems with cuts because those can be pressured, but you do have problems with swelling in your joints, and everybody gets a swelling in their joint, but it's repaired so quickly. In my case, it's not repaired, and so I got these very bad bleedings into my joints.
And what about bruises?
Bruises are a little less of a problem than you might think. It's really the joint bleeding, which eventually corrodes the joint and caused me to lose the ability to walk when I was a child.
And then as an adult, you acquired HIV and hepatitis C through blood transfusions that you got for your hemophilia. Today you have a new liver, your hepatitis is gone, the HIV is under control, and the hemophilia has been cured?
This is one reason why I wrote the book. It's such an amazing story.
Can you cure hemophilia? It's
you
genetic.
You can cure hemophilia. So, as you say, I contracted HIV in 1978, very, very early. We discovered this in 1984 when they developed the antibodies. By 1995,
so you'd been living with it for
34 years.
No, but I mean, you lived with HIV for 6 years.
I lived it. Well,
before you even found out.
I wasn't aware of it.
Yeah.
And then they found out that I was HIV positive. And then after 17 years, by 1995, I went in to see doctors at Mass General and said, why am I still alive and why am I healthy? And they said, let's look into that. Turns out that I'm one of the very rare people who have a genetic resistance to HIV. Tiny number of people, called an elite controller. And they did a lot of new research, and they have been examining people like me to try and discover the key to AIDS. But to your point about hemophilia, the protein that's missing from my blood is made in the liver. And so when I got hepatitis and had to have a new liver in order to prevent me from dying, it had this strange benefit of actually curing my hemophilia.
But there's no link between the hemophilia and the fact that you're resistant to HIV?
No. Both are genetic happenstance. There had never been any hemophilia in my family. We had to cope with that for a long period of time. Then it seemed like I was headed out the door because of these various viruses. And then it turns out that I was restored.
Ironic that your father wrote about the czars and hemophilia was a part of that whole family history?
Well, my parents were and are superb journalists and historians. And when I had hemophilia, one of the ways they coped with this is to explore everything they could, medically, historically. And that led them both to review the story of Alexis, who had hemophilia, the heir to the Russian throne. And they found that most people had misinterpreted the family dynamics, the role of Rasputin, and so forth. So that set my father off on writing a new book, and he had never written before, and it turned out to be very successful, partly because he portrayed this puzzle in a new light.
Now, as a child, I would assume that you were rather sickly, and perhaps more isolated than other kids because of all the concerns about your medical condition. How did you remain engaged in the world?
Well, I had a very lively personality, and so sickly can also imply depressed. I was not depressed. I was a happy child. I was energetic, but I was often stopped cold by these bleedings that would paralyze me, an elbow, an ankle, a knee. And those were very frustrating times. I was ravenously curious. So I read everything. I read the TV guide. I read the Sears catalog. I watched TV. Anybody who came through the door, I would quiz.
But you couldn't play with kids.
I could play a bit. But kids, particularly when they saw my leg braces, they were nervous about me. So I became very intellectually restless. I don't know what I would have done if we had the internet at the time, but I was I grabbed everything I could to learn as much as I could.
Your subtitle in this book is Memoir of Resilience, but the illnesses you've had to battle are not the focus of the story you tell here. You devote many more chapters to your activism and your work on behalf of others. Did your health issues contribute to your interest in a life of service?
Well, thank you. That's really the core thing I was trying to describe in this book, is how, starting with my own experience, I sort of gradually expanded to be aware of other struggles that people were going through in circles around me, issues of race, gradually issues of injustice, nationally, internationally. And this expanding awareness led to me to be engaged. I could always make a personal connection to my own experience. And in some sense, I think it made me feel a deep energy to act on these things. But yes, the medical story and experience is deeply intertwined with how I chose to react to that in the different work that I was able to do.
For example, when you were working with Scoop Jackson and researched the growing risk of contamination in blood products, including the concentrated form of clotting factor that recently revolutionized hemophilia treatment, but that was before you were your blood was contaminated with HIV and hepatitis C.
That is an irony, and really a tragic story, because there was some suspicion that maybe these blood products, because they were drawn from poor and less well people and pooled, that they might be contaminated with various products. And there had been reports of other forms of hepatitis popping up after people got these injections. And Senator Jackson looked into it, and then it was blocked in the Congress by the Republican participation on that investigation committee.
And for what reason?
Well,
just to save money?
It was Senator Charles Percy of Illinois, who was a moderate Republican, but from the state with the home of many pharmaceutical companies, they found this burdensome and intrusive. They felt that Senator Jackson had no right to ask these questions. And so the investigation was halted, and Senator Jackson ran for president. Jimmy Carter became president instead. So history moved on, but just 4 or 5 years later, HIV swept through the hemophilia population and killed 8,000 or 10,000 people. I'm very rare to have survived that generation, because so many people were damaged by that.
Were you thinking of a career in politics at the time?
Actually, no. Initially, I was down in the U.S. Senate during the time of the Watergate hearings. They were taking place in the same building that I was walking around doing intern-like jobs. And I thought politics was a really contaminated field. But later, when I had the chance to spend a lot of time in South Africa, I wrote a long book about South Africa, watched South Africa rewrite its constitution, and this tremendous burst of enthusiasm for democracy, I came back and thought, well, maybe we should embrace what we have in the United States, and maybe I should engage in a new way. And so I decided to go into politics after having rejected it for a very long time.
You ran for lieutenant governor of Massachusetts.
I did. And
didn't win?
No, but I won the primary, which was a surprise. I was only 37. I'd never run for anything before, and I won a statewide primary. So that was a thrilling experience, kind of whet my appetite. And I don't recommend it for everyone, but if you like to talk and you care about the issues, you're interested in people, it can be quite a fascinating thing to do.
And then last year you considered running for Senate and eventually bowed out. So Elizabeth Warren could have a clearer field?
A couple of us got going in the race because we weren't clear who was going to run. There was a mayor of the town of Newton and several other candidates, and we were going around the state meeting with people, and then suddenly the race became nationalized very quickly. The White House stepped in. They promoted Elizabeth Warren, who's a wonderful person, for the race. She raised millions of dollars, and that's a political reality, and all of us who had been in the race said, okay, and stepped out.
My guest is Bob Massey. He's written a memoir called The Song of the Night, a memoir of resilience. Interestingly, this is all Democratic politics, and yet your mother worked for the Reagan administration. Didn't
well, she didn't so much work with. She was introduced to President Reagan because after the Korean airliner was shot down, and she was someone who spent a lot of time in Russia and was known to be briefing both Republican and Democratic senators. And she ended up carrying a back channel message from the Russians, met with National Security Advisor Bud McFarlane, and then was introduced to President Reagan. My mother is a wonderful storyteller, and she was able to make vivid the lives of Russian people and to help President Reagan understand that the Soviet system and the domination of communism was not the same as the sort of Russian heart and Russian spirit. And he was fascinated by this, and he invited her to return for many, many conversations. And she's credited with really changing his attitude so that he was able to engage with President Gorbachev.
Now, talking about changing attitudes, you lived in Massachusetts, you have, for 27 years, and that includes the time when Mitt Romney was governor. Did you support Romney Care, the Massachusetts health care insurance reform that's the model for the new federal law?
Well, let me just back up and say that I lived in France when I was in high school, and even though I was a foreign citizen— and simply a resident, I was covered under French national health insurance, which is excellent. And I owe my ability to walk partly because I received excellent products from the French system at a time that it might have been difficult to get them in the U.S. So I'm a huge fan.
And would have cost your family hundreds of thousands of dollars.
So my belief is that the United States is long, long overdue in establishing national health insurance. I was glad to see when it sort of began to get toehold through the actions of the Democratic legislature and Governor Romney, and I was glad to see Obamacare. Now, of course, I would have liked to have seen it more expansive and more comprehensive, but as I say, we're long overdue. Healthcare is a right everywhere else in the world and absolutely ought to be here.
You write that you were raised as a nominal Christian, attending church only on Christmas and Easter. So what led you to get a degree from the Yale Divinity School? You're an Episcopal priest.
Well, it was a gradual process of transformation and trying to understand the role of suffering in my own life and my experience of suffering in other people's lives. And for me, the idea of a God who is deeply caring, who's concerned, who allows us to build community among us, and the story of Jesus himself began to move me in new ways. I went to divinity school partly to explore my faith. I found that it just grew tremendously while I was there. It allowed me a peace and a sense of a grace that I had not had in other settings, and that led me into ministry. But it was always a ministry interested in engagement with economic and justice issues. I never really thought of myself as being a parish minister, even though I was here in New York City at 10th Street and Broadway at Grace Church in my first parish as an assistant.
And then you were also the pastor for 3 years at Christ Church in Somerville, Massachusetts, but no more?
Then I became a professor at Harvard Divinity School and in a sense moved into more of the teaching and activism role, but I still preach when I'm invited, and I'm now 30 years past my ordination.
You also have been a strong activist against apartheid in South Africa, starting when you were just 15. That's because you saw a film that moved you?
There was an extraordinary man named Nana Mahomo who was assembling a film about South Africa from smuggled footage. And I'd never heard of South Africa. I was invited to meet him and see an example of it, and I was just shocked that there was an entire country built on the idea that one should be denied political and economic rights because of the color of your skin. It was a completely new idea to me, and started me on a long path for the next 20 or 25 years.
Which led you to writing your Harvard Business School dissertation on large American investors like university endowments and foundations that had substantial investments in Africa. So that led you to write your first book, Loosing the Bonds.
Yeah.
And that was an account of how anti-apartheid crusaders in America waged economic war in South Africa. Do you think that's what really brought down apartheid?
Well, I do. First of all, the book was in some ways about this parallel universe between the United States with its complex story about race and South Africa. And each saw in the other a kind of strange reflection. So they were mutually fascinated and in some ways mutually dependent. Yes, I do. I think that wasn't the only thing, but South Africa's economy was not that big. And when American companies that had a major role there began withdrawing their support, withdrawing their loans and so forth, it sent a powerful signal that caused South African government to change.
Despite the promise of Nelson Mandela, South Africa continues to have real problems. Do you continue being involved in
China? I haven't been for quite
some
time, and that's partly because of this liver disease that isolated me for 7 years. I just had to go home and wait for the possibility of transplant. I just passed the 3-year anniversary of that transplant, and I'm hoping to go to South Africa in the next year. So my 14-year-old daughter, Katie, is extremely eager for me to take her, so I think that's going to happen.
This March, you became president and CEO of the New Economics Institute. What's your mission there?
New Economics Institute grew out of something called the E.F. Schumacher Society, an early economist who looked at environmental issues, wrote a book called Small is Beautiful. There are many Americans who are dissatisfied with the way the economy is functioning in terms of providing jobs, protecting the environment, allowing for communities to flourish and grow. Innovation is taking place all across the United States. The role of the New Economics Institute is just sort of catalog and catalyze that change across America. We just had a wonderful conference with 300 organizations exploring all these new ways to make prosperity.
Now, you grew up the son of two writers. Mm-hmm. Does that mean that you almost had to be a writer yourself?
Well, my parents write for a living. I learned about writing from them, and it became a natural form of expression. But it's not something I consider that at my core identity.
Bob Massey's book, A Song in the Night, A Memoir of Resilience, is published by Doubleday and the Nantahlis imprint. And I want to thank you so much for being on our show.
My pleasure. Thank you, Leonard.